whether Levine knew about Datek's fraudulent activities. Given Levine's sharp mind, many found it hard to believe he was completely in the dark. They thought Levine justified Datek's actions because he believed NASDAQ's rules were unfair and deserved to be broken for the broader good. Apparently embittered by it all, Levine decided to move on, quietly and without fanfare. No press release announced his departure. Many of the Island team that worked at InstaNet didn't even know that Levine had left the company. They simply noticed that the Elfin programmer wasn't around anymore to help them out when they got in a jam. Like one of General MacArthur's old soldiers, Levine just faded away to chase new dreams. He dabbled in wind power and created a computerized system to automatically create legal documents, called LawDact. "I really think that it could change the world," he wrote on his website, josh.com, comparing LawDact to the formal logic of the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, written by Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. It was an echo of the grand ambition of Island's glory days, but few were paying attention. Levine's role as the chief architect of the most transformational technology in the history of Wall Street was unheralded, unknown to all but a few people who'd seen it happen. "Talking to Josh was like staring into the sun," says Matt Andreessen. "He could tell you the grass is blue and the sky is green, and you're like, is that really true? You'd have to think about it." Levine had never wanted fame. He'd always shunned the limelight, letting others such as Citron and Andreessen take the credit for his innovations. In a 1999 email exchange with a Wired reporter — the programmer would communicate with reporters only through email, and he never consented to have a photo taken for a single article — he expressed a powerful aversion to celebrity. "Any story about Island should not include a picture of me, and any story about me will not enjoy my cooperation," he wrote. "I have learned the hard way that I do not want to be a famous person, and I will do anything in my power to prevent it." While Levine hadn't racked up the hundreds of millions pocketed by Citron and Mashler, he'd fared well enough. In 2004, he paid $3.75 million in cash for a vacant 13,000-square-foot, five-story brick warehouse on historic Water Street in Lower Manhattan. The 1830s Greek Revival building became his new home, doubling as a laboratory where he could pursue projects such as his solar power system in a box concept. In the next few years, Levine would construct a field of solar panels in the land surrounding an upstate New York retreat. From the sidelines, he watched the market he'd helped create turn into a gigantic computerized speed machine. He found the race to zero deeply troubling. "People, machines, now have to race to be the first person at a fixed price level," he wrote in a July 2011 email. "This has the effect of forcing marketplaces to compete in latency. You end up with exactly what you have now. People spending millions, billions of dollars to save milliseconds, microseconds soon. What an expensive and needless mess. You could probably find a cure for cancer in a year if you just reassigned all the smart people who are now working on this artificially created and otherwise useless problem." The legacy of the Datek gang, while deeply controversial, was nothing less than astonishing. Mashler, Citron, and Levine had gone head-to-head with a corrupt, self-dealing network of NASDAQ market makers and helped destroy it. Island was a classic example of the massively disruptive computer technology that started sweeping across the world in the last 50 years. The epitome of Joseph Schumpeter's perennial gale of creative destruction behind capitalism. Fueled by Island, a new breed of dealers, quick-draw computer outfits like ATD, TradeBot, Getco, and Timber Hill, were the new market makers. And Island's progeny fanned out across Wall Street, a technocratic vanguard of elite players. And for a time, it looked as if Levine's vision of a seamless, nearly free market had come to pass. As the market makers and specialists fell by the wayside, trading costs plunged. It seemed as if the plumbers had built a magnificent machine that was expanding the wealth of all Americans. But somewhere along the line, the message was lost, co-opted by a newly enriched technorati. Levine's disciples would continue to pay lip service to the arguments Levine had made against NASDAQ and the NYSE in the 1990s, as a bulwark of their own newfound position as king of the hill. Any critic who complained of their push-button speeds, their machine-gun trades, their complex plumbing games that had turned the market into a video game casino, was roundly dismissed as a Luddite who didn't favor competition or a level playing field. But the field wasn't level. It never had been. The new hierarchy would be all about who owned the most powerful computers, the fastest links between markets, the most sophisticated algorithms, and the inside knowledge of how the market's plumbing was put together. A revolution born from the idealistic belief that technology could shine a light on the dark forces of finance was being corrupted. Part 3. It is over. The trading that existed down the centuries has died. We have an electronic market today. It is the present. It is the future. NASDAQ CEO Robert Greifeld, May 2011. Triumph of the Machine. Chapter 18. The Beast. Jerry Putnam stepped into the New York Stock Exchange through a back door in the western wing of the exchange's storied building. Archipelago's general counsel, Kevin O'Hara, and several other members of the Chicago firm's team were close behind. It was the afternoon of April 20, 2005, a Wednesday. Putnam was sweating beneath his suit from nervousness and the heat. Outside, it was pushing 90 degrees. The sky was dark blue. A few clouds floated far above the skyline, and a cool breeze was blowing along the buzzing streets of Lower Manhattan. Putnam and Co., escorted by a team of handlers, walked through a labyrinth of dimly lit hallways, stairwells, and elevators, and finally entered a sixth-floor room adjoining a press bullpen. It was a surreal moment. As they sat, waiting to face a gathering herd of financial reporters, they were tense, exhilarated, and exhausted. O'Hara glanced at Putnam and smiled nervously. "We're in the belly of the beast," he said. Putnam laughed. He could scarcely believe what he had accomplished in a matter of 8 years since dreaming up Archipelago on a sickbed in Chicago. The previous August, Archipelago had gone public. Earlier that morning, the boards of the NYSE and Archipelago had approved a blockbuster deal that would transform the U.S. trading landscape. A new public company, NYSE Group, would be formed, ending the big board status as a not-for-profit concern. From then on, the NYSE would be driven by the bottom line. Its ticker symbol would be NYX. The deal initially valued the combined entity, which would be the largest stock market in the world, at $3.5 billion. The NYX stock was the primary currency of the deal. The 1,366 NYSE seat holders would receive stock and cash, valuing the seats at about $2 million apiece, roughly double what they'd been selling for months before the merger was announced. The merger had been hammered out in record time. Putnam held frequent one-on-one discussions with NYSE CEO John Thain, a former Goldman executive who'd taken the post in 2003, soon after Dick Grosso had been forced to step down amid a scandal over his massive pay package. Since first meeting to discuss the tie-up at Goldman Sachs headquarters on January 20th, Putnam and Thain had been surrounded by furious activity. Teams of lawyers, exchange executives, Goldman honchos, and Archipelago staffers worked around the clock as they worked out the details of the blockbuster deal with the utmost secrecy. On January 28th, Putnam had addressed Archipelago's board, revealing that he'd been in preliminary discussions with the NYSE about a merger. He urged everyone to keep quiet. If news of the talks broke, the whole thing could fall apart. Archipelago's stock price would skyrocket, and NYSE old-timers would scream bloody murder. To maintain secrecy, Archipelago was referred to in meetings as Army. The NYSE was Navy. By mid-March, the deal was ready. Top negotiators met on March 21st at Goldman's Broad Street headquarters. In attendance were Duncan Niederauer, John Thain, and Jerry Putnam. Goldman dealmaker David Schwimmer joined by telephone. The biggest question concerned how to slice up the pie of the combined entity. Putnam pushed for a 40% allocation to Archipelago shareholders. Thain said New York seat holders would accept nothing less than 70%, leaving a 30% slice to Archipelago. After some haggling, Thain's plan stuck. Archipelago investors would get about one-third of the combined exchange, netting Putnam & Co. north of $1 billion. NYSE stakeholders would pocket the remaining 70% slice of the pie. Conflicts of interest abounded. A particularly thorny issue concerned the status of Goldman Sachs, which was on both sides of the deal, as advisors to both the NYSE and Archipelago. It owned a 15% stake in Archipelago, and it held a block of NYSE seats through its ownership of the specialist firm Speer, Leeds & Kellogg, which Niederauer had run. Indeed, Goldman's ties to Archipelago were so strong that many viewed the exchange as Goldman's personal ECN unit. The idea to get Goldman on both sides had been Putnam's. So concerned that word about the deal would leak, he felt that limiting the number of bankers involved could reduce the chances that someone would talk. He'd also know who to blame if there was a leak. News of the merger hit the wires just after the market closed on April 20th, a Wednesday, as Putnam and O'Hara were wending their way through the bowels of the exchange. It rocked the financial world. Archipelago's stock shot up 60% to nearly $30 a share in after-hours trading. Putnam marveled as he saw his stock surge on his BlackBerry while waiting for the press conference. In a flash, his net worth had dramatically improved. At 5 p.m., Thain took the podium. "I'm very excited to announce the transaction today, and I think it combines the best features of the New York Stock Exchange and our auction model with Archipelago's leading technology," he said. Thain went on to outline the details of the deal and how the NYSE management would look once it was consummated. He handed the microphone to Putnam. "I'm starting with Archipelago's goals slide," he said, opening up a PowerPoint presentation. "Our goals have not changed from what we've stated when we went public in August." Putnam spoke as if this were business as usual for Archipelago, as if he believed Archipelago was taking over the NYSE rather than the reverse. Putnam was a true believer. In his mind, the NYSE was little more than a strong brand name with a very bad business model. Archipelago had the right model. Now it had the brand. "We believe in order for us to be successful, we're going to have to build a strong brand," he said. "We've invested heavily in that brand, and I think that this merger certainly gets us far, far, far along beyond anything that we've failed to do on our own." With such brash talk, Putnam seemed convinced he was on the verge of taking over the front office at New York. But he was deeply conflicted. He'd seen the NYSE as the enemy for so long that it was hard to reconcile himself with his new position as a top dog at the big board, the belly of the beast. Immediately after the press conference, Putnam grabbed a flight back to Chicago. He wanted to be in Archipelago's office the following morning to greet his team and help allay any concerns that he was turning his back on his belief in open and fair markets. It was a tough sell. But one factor helped ease Putnam's pitch: Archipelago's soaring stock price. Employees who'd been struggling for years in a business that often seemed on the edge of going under were suddenly much wealthier. Their consciences might sting a bit, but their fatter bank accounts eased the pain. The NYSE Archipelago deal was a watershed in U.S. financial history. It signaled that the storied floor of the big board, a symbol of capitalism known around the world, was no longer dominant. While Thain mouthed faith in the floor, he was well aware that it had become a prop, background color for financial news networks that advertised the NYSE brand. Computers would rule. Nothing could stop that. No one was more aware of that shift than the man many credited as the secret architect of the NYSE Archipelago merger, Duncan Niederauer. The Goldman Sachs executive had championed Goldman's 1999 investment in the ECN, and he'd been a behind-the-scenes force in putting John Thain in the top spot at the NYSE. Soon after the deal was consummated, Niederauer received emails congratulating him on the deal. "Looks like your baby has finally grown up," wrote one correspondent in an email with a subject line that read, "GS taking over the world," or "NYSE merges with ARCA." In fact, soon after the merger, traders coined a new name for the big board, the Goldman Sachs Exchange. Dick Grosso, watching the details of the merger on CNBC from his home in Locust Valley, New York, was devastated, on the point of tears. His long, hard-fought battle to protect the floor was over. An American institution was dying. "This is a very sad day," he told friends. Many at the NYSE were furious at the ARCA deal. Floor traders and specialists, bitterly resentful of the shift toward electronic trading, started referring to Thane as iRobot for his stiff mechanical style and his apparent allegiance to the bots. It was clear that the lion's share of trading at New York was going electronic. The floor of the NYSE was becoming little more than a showpiece. "The writing is on the wall for the floor," Jamie Selway, who'd left Archipelago in 2003 to form his own broker-dealer, told the Wall Street Journal when the Archipelago deal was announced. Putnam had achieved his dream. He was at the very center of the financial universe, the biggest pool of them all. Named co-president of the NYSE, he was in charge of the electronic trading arm of the exchange. His number two man was Paul Adcock, who'd been with Putnam from the beginning in the early 1990s. Along with an experienced team of technologists from Archipelago, they quickly started working on integrating the electronic system into the NYSE. It would be their toughest job yet. 2 days after the NYSE Archipelago deal was announced, came news of another blockbuster merger. NASDAQ had agreed to purchase the trading engine owned by Instanet, the computer system formerly known as Island, for $935 million. It was a Friday afternoon. NASDAQ's CEO, Bob Greifeld, was convinced he'd pulled off a better deal than Thane had. Archipelago had notoriously clunky technology. Instanet had the Island system, the most powerful stock trading machine ever created. The deal had been championed behind the scenes at NASDAQ by a one-time Island attorney named Chris Concannon. In 2003, Concannon had left Instanet to become executive vice president of market operations at NASDAQ. His number one goal, as he told Greifeld from the very beginning, was to take out the New York Stock Exchange. With Island in his arsenal, he felt the odds had tipped dramatically in his favor. Levine, of course, was nowhere to be seen as America's leading stock markets adapted to the grand vision he'd built as a nerdy teenager pounding the pavement of Wall Street in the 1980s, peddling computer trading systems to banks and hedge funds. Not a single article in the major financial press mentioned the programmer. But it was clear to insiders such as Concannon that Island had always been the driving force behind the changes that were transforming Wall Street. Decimalization, co-location, access to data, lightning speeds, high-frequency trading. Those changes were also moving overseas. When Instanet sold the Island system to NASDAQ, it had agreed not to launch competing technology in the United States. But the deal said nothing about Europe. So Brian Negito, the Island technologist who had rewritten the system's code into Java years earlier, built a new electronic trading platform called ChaiX Europe, which Instanet would fully launch in 2007. The name derives from the Greek letter chi, C-H-I, written as capital X, which represents the crossing of two sides of a trade. Within just a few years, ChaiX Europe would account for more than one quarter of all stock trading in Europe. Besides advances in trading technology, there was a powerful force pushing the big board and NASDAQ toward modernization, a massive change to the structure of the market that was, metaphorically, a gun aimed squarely at the head of the NYSE. Designed by a small group of SEC eggheads, it was called Regulation National Market System, or Reg NMS. The very rule changes that eventually would spark the market structure quirks that plagued Chaim Bodek and trading machines. In the works for years, Reg NMS mandated that any order to buy or sell a stock had to go to the venue that had the best price. If an investor placed an order to buy Intel at the NYSE, where it was selling for $20.01, and if there was a better price at NASDAQ, say $20, the order would instantly route to NASDAQ. Such a system had become possible with the growth of electronic trading. Reg NMS also proposed to alter a convention that had ring-fenced floor trading on the big board. The NYSE's floor often took 10 or 20 seconds to execute a trade, light years compared with split-second trading on electronic venues such as Island and Archipelago. It was the problem that had stifled high-speed players such as Dave Cummings and forced them to stick with their bread-and-butter NASDAQ stocks. Reg NMS would put an end to this regime by allowing firms to trade through human-controlled manual markets. If Cummings wanted to buy 200 shares of IBM, an NYSE-listed stock, he could go straight to Archipelago or another ECN, because the NYSE's human dealers were too slow. He could do this even if IBM shares were cheaper at the NYSE. Reg NMS, in essence, decreed that speed was more important than price. As such, Reg NMS represented a potential death blow to the big board, where price, along with human trading, was paramount. Suddenly, electronic traders would be able to swap NYSE-listed stocks at will, bypassing the floor entirely. For market centers that met the speed standard, Reg NMS met something else entirely. The basic rule still applied. Any order sent to the market must trade at the best price. If IBM shares were selling for $20 on NASDAQ and $19.99 on Archipelago, a buy order would have to route to Archipelago. Because the speed of the electronic links between exchanges was nearly instantaneous, routing orders to the best price in this way wasn't expected to cause any delay in getting a fill. The SEC, after mulling over Reg NMS for more than a year, passed the rule in early 2005, although it wasn't fully implemented until the summer of 2007. For the NYSE, it was a matter of life and death. Unless it ramped up its electronic trading capabilities, Reg NMS would shred it to pieces. Its revenues would fall. Its competitors would become stronger. NASDAQ was also at risk, since its computer systems remained much slower than Island and Archipelago. To compete, they had to tool up double time. Archipelago was the NYSE's quick fix. The Island system was NASDAQ's. NASDAQ signaled that it planned to migrate all of its trading to InstaNet, i.e. Island, within a year of the merger. Supermontage, its own attempt to compete with the ECNs, would be scrapped. Soon after the NASDAQ-InstaNet deal closed and the Island system was officially running NASDAQ, Chris Concannon invited Levine to its downtown headquarters to have lunch with CEO Bob Greifeld. Levine showed up in his usual attire, tennis shoes, baggy shorts, T-shirt. Dressed in a crisp suit and tie, Greifeld was bemused by the programming wunderkind, whom he'd heard about through the years but had never met. Levine expressed little interest in the merger or Greifeld's grand plans. Instead, he spent most of the time talking about a solar farm he was cobbling together at his retreat in upstate New York. Concannon shook his head. Levine seemed to have little interest in the fact that his creation was now the engine running one of the largest stock trading platforms in the world. Now Concannon himself was helping run Levine's masterpiece. It would mark the most significant deal in NASDAQ's history up to that point. Almost immediately after the integration was complete, NASDAQ's market share started to improve. The deal also started to fulfill Concannon's vision when he'd first come to NASDAQ, taking over a chunk of the trading of New York-listed stocks. A different story entirely was playing out at the NYSE. As the ink was drying on the NYSE merger, Putnam's team started combing over New York's technology. What they found startled them. Walking through the exchange's floor, they'd hear the manic click-clack of typing, a noise that sounded like a forest full of crickets. The sound was emanating from the NYSE's dot typists. Orders that flooded in through the dot computer system, short for designated order turnaround, had to be matched by human beings. A printer published the orders on paper. a wall of typists would bang out matching orders at a frantic pace. It was impressive. They were the fastest typists Putnam had ever seen. But this was 2005. To Putnam, it was a symbol of just how far behind the big board had gotten. It was absurd. The NYSE for years had boasted of huge investments in technology as it struggled to keep pace with competitors. But as Archipelago's computer experts dug into the spaghetti tangle of the big board's computers, they found a complete mess. A Rube Goldberg machine stood behind the world's most famous stock exchange. The latest software was running on computers installed around the time of Black Monday in 1987. The New York Stock Exchange is held together by chicken wire and bubble gum, Putnam's team thought. Putnam and his partner, Paul Adcock, along with Archipelago's top tech specialists, poured themselves into the job, working on the integration even before the merger was finalized in early March 2006. Putnam holed up in an apartment in New York, commuting on weekends, those he could spare, back to Chicago. Resistance to the electronic herd remained fierce among the old guard at the NYSE, especially on the floor. Archipelago team members working to integrate the computer systems amid the hive-like activity during the trading day might suddenly take a painful thump on the shoulder or in the back. The action was so frenetic that it was hard to tell where the blow came from. But the message was clear. To break the ice, Putnam arranged to have breakfast with the top representatives of the NYSE floor at the Private Stock Exchange Luncheon Club, a hallowed space reserved only for NYSE members and famed for its clam juice and vodka cocktail known as a Red Snapper. As he walked into the room in the early morning hours, well before the opening bell, a steady chatter died to icy silence. Putnam sat down at his table, trying to avoid the cold stares directed his way from all parts of the room by some of the most powerful men in finance. After breakfast had been served, he stood and cleared his throat. "As you all know, I'm a fierce competitor," he said. "Before the deal, this was a competition, and I did everything in my power to beat you." He looked around. The cold stares were turning into fiery daggers. "Now, I'm on the team. I'm with you, and I'm ready to do whatever it takes to win." Despite such assurances, the NYSE specialists remained skeptical. They were keepers of the tradition, of the ways of the past. Putnam was the future. There was no getting around the contradictions. Meanwhile, the IPO of the NYSE group, which would occur when the merger was finalized, was moving up fast. It proved to be a huge media event, covered live by financial news networks CNBC and Bloomberg. The date was set for March 6th, soon after the merger received a thumbs up from regulators. The company would have a market capitalization of about $10 billion, triple NASDAQ size. The morning of the offering, NYSE officials on the floor passed out silver bells emblazoned with NYX on the handle. Traders were told to ring them with abandon at the open. While they were billed as a shiny memento, their true purpose, to drown out the expected chorus of boos and catcalls from disaffected specialists, spoke volumes about the turmoil behind the scenes. The IPO marked a crucial shift for the NYSE. As a publicly traded entity, it would see profits as paramount, and relationships with revenue-generating clients would become all the more critical. Thane continued slashing costs, shutting down the NYSE's wood-paneled dining room where traders and Wall Street executives had gathered for decades to talk shop over steaming omelets and French toast before the start of the trading day. The floor started to shrink as specialists closed shop. In June 2006, Thane axed the exchange's beloved barber, a 43-year employee named Gerardo Gentilella, who worked for a meager annual stipend of $24,000. Even after Gentilella asked to work for tips through the end of the year, Thane stood by his guns and sent the barber packing. The changes rocking the NYSE were the direct result of the computer trading revolution sparked more than a decade before at 50 Broad. The upstart ECNs that had transformed the market now were the market. fueled by the massive volume spawned by the high-frequency traders, the ECNs had been pulling in so much liquidity that the big board and NASDAQ simply bought out their competitors and integrated their technology. One major player in high frequency wasn't pleased with these developments. TradeBot's Dave Cummings. Cummings was furious that the major exchanges had swallowed up his favorite trading centers. He was certain that in short order the exchanges would boost fees, resulting in a direct hit to TradeBot's bottom line. So, soon after the mergers, Cummings announced that he would launch his own ECN, Better Alternative Trading System, or BATS. Designed to be cheap and fast, BATS would put pressure on the big exchanges to keep their fees in check. There was little question that the BATS system was designed to mimic Island. Cummings had spent so much time on the phone with Island programmers that he knew its structure inside out. The likeness was obvious to insiders. For instance, Cummings dubbed the BATS market data feed Fast Pitch, just as Levine had called his data feed Itch. From all signs, BATS worked extremely well. By 2007, it had gobbled up more than 10% of all trading volume. And Cummings' high-speed colleagues-in-arms were along for the ride. A big investor in BATS, for instance, was Getco, his one-time partner in Chicago. Cummings wasn't alone in setting up new trading centers. In 2005, Jersey City-based broker-dealer giant Knight Capital Group purchased an ECN that had been languishing on the periphery of the trading world for years. Attain, the electronic trading platform created in 1998 by Harvey Houtkin, the original SOS bandit. Knight renamed it Direct Edge, and it soon became the fourth largest trading venue for stocks in the United States, just behind BATS. A Direct Edge investor was Citadel, which operated one of the world's top high-frequency operations, called Tactical Trading. For a time, Tactical had been run by ex-Island programmer Brian Negito. Regulators didn't bat an eye. They didn't seem to question whether it was appropriate for several of the nation's most prolific electronic trading firms, Getco, TradeBot, Knight, Citadel, to have such close ties with exchanges. Already, of course, the NYSE and NASDAQ had swallowed up Island and Archipelago, which had been the primary breeding grounds of high-speed trading. The career direction could go the other way as well. In 2007, Cummings stepped down from BATS to recharge TradeBot's engines. Industry gossip was that Cummings saw how powerful Getco had become while at BATS, which processed many of Getco's orders, and wanted to do the same for TradeBot. And some competitors were concerned that Cummings had been able to get a glimpse of their strategies while at BATS. Whether it was appropriate for the manager of a national market center to jump ship and run a powerful trading firm was, once again, not questioned by regulators. It proved excellent timing, however. As Reg NMS rolled out in the summer of 2007, high-frequency traders were suddenly able to apply their strategies to many of the largest, most heavily traded stocks in the world. NYSE-listed stocks, such as IBM, General Electric, and Alcoa. Before Reg NMS, it was difficult for fast traders to juggle NYSE stocks because of the slow response times on the floor of the big board. But Reg NMS stipulated that electronic venues could bypass the floor. The bots were kids in a candy store, and their revenues fattened accordingly. Getco, said to have pulled in as much as $50 million in 2006, was suddenly making as much as $9 million a day in 2007, according to a person familiar with its operation. In 2008, when trading volumes spiked during the credit crisis, the result of lots of funds selling everything they could in a panic, the high-speed operation at the Chicago hedge fund Citadel, Tactical Trading, raked in $1 billion. Indeed, 2007 to 2008, a time when most of Wall Street was falling apart at the seams, would be the heyday for the bots. That would all change in the summer of 2009. In a matter of days, the computer-driven world that Island had helped spawn would come under a giant microscope. Chapter 19. The Platform. From Mikhail Melyshev, sent 11:11 p.m. to Sergei Alenikov, re, Let's Move Fast. It was nearing midnight as Sergei Alenikov nervously clicked on the email from his future boss. The subject line, "Let's move fast," said it all. Mikhail Misha Malyshev wasn't one to waste time. Speed was paramount. Speed was everything. "There's a huge amount of work ahead of us," the email said. "Let's triple our focus. The future is ours, and the game is already on." The message was clear. Alenikov, who'd emigrated from Russia to the United States in 1991, knew he had to act quickly. He had to act fast. It was May 31st, 2009, and pressure was mounting. Speed was the game, in more ways than one. Alenikov was a merchant of speed, a computer programmer for a secretive high-frequency trading operation run by Goldman Sachs. The operation was the heir of Hull Trading, the options trading group that Goldman had purchased for $500 million in 1999, and that had employed such trading whizzes as Chaim Bodek and Dave Babalak, head trader at Getco in Chicago. Alenikov's job at Goldman? Write code that processed trades as quickly as possible. The code was the key. Whoever had the best code, the fastest code, won the game. The algorithms were the futuristic space-age progeny of SO's bandit weapons, such as the Monster Key, category-killing secret trading systems of the Algo Wars that generated massive profits. That was why Malyshev had hired the 39-year-old Alenikov, for his ability to write fast code. Malyshev, who sported a PhD in physics from Princeton University, was a rising legend in the world of high-speed trading. He'd run Citadel's powerhouse high-speed outfit, Tactical Trading, which had pulled in a stunning $1 billion in 2008, netting Malyshev alone $70 million for the year. Now he was launching his own trading machine, named Teza, after a river in his home country of Russia, and hiring top talent, math whizzes and computer geeks, like Alenikov. Indeed, one of his first hires had been former Island Tech guru Will Sterling. After reading the email at his home in the Tony, New Jersey township of North Caldwell, Alenikov went to bed. But his mind was racing. He didn't have much time. He had only one more week at Goldman. He had to act fast. The next morning, he woke up early, caught a commuter train to New York, and calmly walked into Goldman's downtown office at 1 New York Plaza. He hopped off an elevator, swiped a badge before the door that gave him access to a top-secret programming room, and went to his desk, busy with an array of computer screens flashing charts of markets from around the world. Alenikov, tall, with sapling-thin limbs, a jet-black goatee, and thin-framed glasses, felt lucky. With Teza, he'd finally caught his big break, the job where he could pull down the big money, the fuck-you Wall Street money that would give him the freedom to do whatever he wanted. Not only was he going to triple his salary from $400,000 a year to nearly $1.2 million, he was getting in on the ground floor of an operation with seemingly limitless potential. But he had to move fast. Later that afternoon, after a full day of trading, Alenikov looked around the office. No one was watching. At about 5:30 p.m., he began to type. He input a series of commands to copy and compress files from Goldman's high-frequency trading system. He encrypted the code using the password, "This is a test." He then accessed a computer server located in Germany and began downloading the encrypted code to the server. The process only took a matter of minutes. Finished, he slipped on his jacket and quickly left the building. A few days later, working from his home computer on the night of June 4th, shortly after 11 p.m., Alenikov accessed the German server, designated svn.xp-dev.com, and uploaded the code. The next day, his last at Goldman, he transferred more code at 7:07 a.m. Then, at 5:23 p.m., he ran a program to upload even more code to the German server. At last, hoping to cover his tracks, he swiped clean his computer's bash history, a record of activity on its hard drive. He shut down the computer, said goodbye to his colleagues, and walked out of Goldman's office for the last time. Alenikov felt positive that he'd pulled it off. With the Goldman code, he'd have a cheat sheet to create new, even better code for Teza. But he'd slipped. Goldman security experts had detected the transfer of exactly 32 megabytes of data from its computer system to an outside server. They then traced the activity to Alenikov's computer. After a sweep of the hard drive, they found everything. On July 1st, the bank notified the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Alenikov was oblivious. He flew to Chicago on July 2nd for a round of meetings with Malyshev and other members of the TASA team. The following day, a Friday, after more meetings, he packed up his laptop, loaded with secret Goldman code, and prepared to leave. Gazing through the tinted panes of a conference room on the 37th floor of the futuristic Smurfit Stone building in downtown Chicago, TASA's headquarters, the dark blue expanse of Lake Michigan stretching into the distance, he had no notion of the powerful forces of law and money marshaling against him 800 miles away. They were all moving fast. The game was on. Alenikov smiled as he said goodbye to Malyshev, hopped on the elevator, and caught a cab to Chicago International O'Hare Airport. He was eager to get home to his wife, Alina, and their three little girls, all under the age of 5. At 9:20 p.m., as he stepped off his plane at Newark Liberty International Airport, 6 agents from the FBI were waiting for him in the terminal. Special Agent Michael McSwain, a stocky man with a salt-and-pepper buzz cut, approached, flashing a badge. "Are you Sergei Alenikov?" he asked in a raspy voice that seemed a dead-on impression of Clint Eastwood. "Yes." "You're under arrest." "This must be a mistake," Alenikov said in a panic. Alenikov was handcuffed, packed into an unmarked car, and taken to the Justice Department's Federal Plaza headquarters in downtown Manhattan. Several hours of intense grilling followed. In a state of shock, Alenikov declined the help of a lawyer. Just 11 minutes into the interrogation, he agreed to let the FBI search his home. He readily confessed that he had taken code from Goldman's high-frequency trading platform. His excuse? He had intended to take so-called open source code, the kind available to anyone over the Internet and used by firms for basic computing functions, and had mistakenly grabbed bits of Goldman's proprietary code. He'd never shown it to Malyshev or anyone else at TASA, he said. The FBI wasn't buying his story. The interrogation ended at 1:45 a.m. Alenikov spent the night behind bars. Special Agent McSwain quickly got to work on his affidavit. He alleged that Alenikov stole proprietary computer code and then uploaded the code to a computer server in Germany. Without naming Goldman specifically, he wrote that the code came from a computer system that allows the financial institution to engage in sophisticated, high-speed, and high-volume trades on various stocks and commodities markets. The platform is capable of quickly obtaining and processing information regarding rapid developments in these markets. The speed and efficiency by which the platform obtains and processes market data allows the financial institution to employ additional programs that use sophisticated mathematical formulas to place automated trades in the markets. Such trades generate many millions of dollars of profits per year for the financial institution. The following day, the 4th of July, U.S. Assistant Attorney Joseph Facciaponte laid out the government's case in a hearing to determine whether the wayward programmer could be freed on bail. The Justice Department was charging Alenikov with what amounted to industrial espionage, a federal offense that could earn him 25 years in prison. Goldman might have suffered massive damages if Alenikov's scheme had succeeded, Facciaponte said. The bank itself stands to lose its entire investment in creating this software to begin with, which is millions upon millions of dollars. Then, the 34-year-old prosecutor dropped a bombshell. Because of the way this software interfaces with various markets and exchanges, the bank has raised the possibility that there is a danger that somebody who knew how to use this program could use it to manipulate markets in unfair ways, he told the court. No one knew quite what that meant, but it was ominous. What kind of spymaster code was this? How dark and complex had the market become? Despite the government's warnings, Alenikov was released on a $750,000 bond. Within days, the arrest was splattered in newspaper headlines across the country. Reporters quickly learned from Alenikov's online work profile on the LinkedIn website that he was a programmer for Goldman Sachs. The scandal cast a lurid light on high-speed trading. In America's heartland, mom-and-pop investors were stunned as they learned what had become of the stock market, the repository of their retirement dreams. It was hard to tell if they were reading The Wall Street Journal, Isaac Asimov, or Ian Fleming. Massive computers wielded by giant financial firms, or small firms they'd never heard of, were processing trades at warp speeds, popping in and out of stocks like bees in a hive. Some reports claimed that high-frequency trading accounted for as much as three-fourths of all volume on the U.S. stock market. What was going on? Where had it all come from? Dan Iwanczyski was traveling in Poland when he received an email containing a Newswire story about the Alenikov case. It was July 4, 2009, one day after the arrest. As he read through the story, Iwanczyski, a pale, dark-haired blogger from Bulgaria, instantly knew something big had happened. A former trader himself, he'd been railing against high-speed trading for months on his new blog, called Zero Hedge. From his spare apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, he'd been posting under the pseudonym Tyler Durden, the name of the psychopathic character in Chuck Palahniuk's novel Fight Club. Few outside his inner circle knew his true identity, but his savvy, number-centric analysis made it obvious to his blog's faithful readers that he'd been a Wall Street insider who couldn't take all the bullshit anymore. Durden's primary target, some might even say morbid obsession, was Goldman Sachs. He'd become convinced that the powerful bank was manipulating markets for its own benefit. Now, it seemed, a federal prosecutor was confirming his suspicions. By the summer of 2009, Zero Hedge had become a must-read for Wall Street insiders. The blog was breaking all the rules, calling all of Wall Street a massive Ponzi scheme that was on the verge of collapsing, crashing the stock market, and leaving the global economy in ruins. The blog's observations combined the sentiment of a crackpot conspiracy theorist with hard-edged economic reporting, often backed with complex analysis of statistics and charts. With Alenikov's arrest, Zero Hedge became an even bigger hit. The story landed squarely in Iwanczyski's wheelhouse, and he swung for the bleachers. From his hotel room in Warsaw, the blogger jumped on his laptop and began typing feverishly. A few hours later, he had a detailed post live on his site, speculating on what the Alenikov arrest could mean. "If the allegations are true," he wrote, "it looks like Goldman's hi-fi quant trading desk was thoroughly penetrated by a spy." One can only imagine the value of this code, not only to Goldman, but to the highest bidder. Suddenly, Zero Hedge was getting swamped with hits, and the mainstream press was soon hot on the trail. In a flash, secretive high-speed computer trading was the subject of water cooler gossip across the country. By September, a Forbes magazine cover story called High-Frequency Trading, "The Most Wrenching and Controversial Transition in the History of U.S. Securities Markets." Critics of high-speed trading suddenly swelled in number. At the front of the pack were Sal Arnick and Joe Saluzzi, two former Instanet traders who in 2002 had founded a brokerage called Themis Trading. Themis was a throwback, a firm that bought and sold stocks for clients using street smarts, not AI-rigged high-speed algos. Saluzzi and Arnick had been on the attack against high-frequency trading since 2008. On June 18, 2009, they published a white paper called High-Frequency Trading, Red Flags, and Drug Addiction. Referring to a panel discussion he'd recently attended, Saluzzi wrote that the high-speed traders participating in the symposium alongside him reminded me of the SOS bandits from the early 90s. The paper zeroed in on the fact that high-frequency firms had virtually zero obligation to stick it out through thick or thin in the market. High-speed firms were canceling orders at a maddening pace. A staggering 90% or more of all of the orders they pumped into the market were canceled. That was not real liquidity, they wrote. That was phantom liquidity, as insubstantial and fleeting as the wind. "What happens if a major event causes turmoil in the market?" the paper asked. "Will these HFTs simply shut down their computers and walk away since their model has been corrupted? What happens to the 60% of the volume that they now control? Where will all that liquidity that they claim to provide go when the market doesn't suit them? A major vacuum will be formed in the market as multiple parties run for a much smaller than expected exit. Experts within the high-frequency community roundly dismissed Arnik and Saluzzi as cranks, reactionary Luddites who long for the days of the ticker tape. They called them dangerous, liable to twist the minds of susceptible and stupid regulators, turning back the clock on the tech revolution on Wall Street and hurting America's ability to compete. Saluzzi and Arnik were morons, and un-American to boot. They felt otherwise, of course. Saluzzi and Arnik were convinced that the market had been hijacked by computer traders while no one was looking, except the regulators, who inexplicably seemed to be helping them along, and they were hell-bent on making as much noise about it as possible. The fight was on. Ted Kaufman knew all about fights and long odds. In 1972, he'd worked on the long-shot senatorial campaign of a brash 29-year-old Delaware politician named Joe Biden. Biden was going up against J. Caleb Boggs, a longtime beloved figure in Delaware. No one thought Biden had a chance, not even Kaufman. On Labor Day, just a few months before the election, polls showed only 19% of voters were behind Biden. Somehow, the man who went on to become vice president in the Obama administration pulled it off, defeating Boggs by a nose. From then on, Kaufman believed anything was possible. A trained engineer with an MBA from Wharton, Kaufman worked as Biden's chief of staff and close advisor for the next two decades. When Biden stepped aside to become vice president in January 2009, Kaufman took his seat in the Senate. Over the next year, the gangly cerebral senator would become the most unlikely critic of high-frequency trading imaginable. Kaufman's interest in computerized trading evolved out of his investigation into the SEC's move in July 2007 to abolish the uptick rule. The rule, which had been in place since 1938, mandated that short sellers, traders hoping to profit from a decline in the price of a stock, could only make a move after the price of the stock ticked up. That helped prevent short sellers from bear raids, in which they piled onto a stock and relentlessly drove it down with short after short. But in the late 1990s and early 2000s, an increasingly powerful group started lobbying for a repeal of the uptick rule. High-speed traders. The need to wait for an uptick in a stock before it could be shorted made it more difficult to jump in and out of stocks at lightning speeds. That, in turn, hurt their ability to provide liquidity to the market, hurting the little guy. Josh Levine, among others, pushed the SEC to repeal the uptick rule. The SEC finally agreed, and on July 6, 2007, the uptick rule was no more. The move attracted little attention at the time, but by the fall of 2008, when the financial system was collapsing and shares of firms such as Lehman Brothers and Morgan Stanley were plunging, the SEC came under heavy fire. In March 2009, Kaufman introduced a bill, along with Johnny Isaacson, a Republican senator from Georgia, calling on the SEC to reinstate the uptick rule within 60 days. As Kaufman dug further into market structure, speaking with experts across the industry, he became increasingly alarmed by what he found: rampant complexity, secretive tactics, hidden, unknowable risks. To him, it all seemed reminiscent of the problems that had led to Wall Street's apocalyptic implosion in 2008, when highly complex mortgage trades led to the loss of hundreds of billions. The public's faith in Wall Street was near historic lows. What worried Kaufman most? A destabilizing event in the stock market triggered by computer trading. That could cause investors to turn their back on Wall Street all over again, hurt the ability of companies to raise funds, and severely damaged the nation's economy. Kaufman started firing off letters to the SEC and editorials to newspapers. "We seem to be learning more every day about certain order types, high-speed trading, co-location of servers at exchanges, dark pools, and other indications that we have a two-tiered market," he wrote in an open letter to the SEC on August 4, 2009. The SEC had promised to take action, but it wasn't moving quickly enough for Kaufman. "We must act urgently because high-frequency trading poses a systemic risk," he told the Senate Banking Committee on November 5th. What kind of risk was Kaufman talking about? A rising concern was that a high-speed firm with poor risk controls could unleash a rogue algorithm into the market and trigger a destabilizing domino effect. A runaway algo could get stuck in a feedback loop, attempting to sell a massive amount of stock and keep selling, relentlessly pushing the entire market lower. With trading systems able to act in microseconds across multiple venues, including dark pools, a destabilizing sell-off could occur in minutes or even seconds. One trading executive said he feared the next long-term capital meltdown will happen in a 5-minute time period, referring to the 1998 implosion of a giant hedge fund that threatened to topple the global financial system. In 2009, however, the majority of the electronic herd saw such concerns as the wild imaginings of conspiracy theorists. Critics such as Kaufman, Zero Hedge's Ivanjiski, Arnuch, and Saluzzi were widely considered dangerous know-nothings, raising false fears and spooking the public. High-speed traders believed they had created a flawless technological masterpiece, a market that was cheaper, more efficient, safer, and more transparent than ever before. Kaufman wasn't buying the hype. He couldn't care less about what he saw as self-righteous justifications for what appeared to be little more than legalized profiteering. Kaufman wasn't worried about the powerful enemies he was making on Wall Street. Since he never intended to run for office again once his term ended in late 2010, he didn't have to worry about raising buckets of cash from deep-pocketed financiers for his next campaign. And despite his growing understanding that the forces he was challenging were far more powerful and complex than he'd ever realized, he refused to shut up and go away. By early 2010, scrutiny of high-frequency trading had reached a fever pitch. Mary Shapiro, chairman of the SEC, realized she needed to act. And so she did what most Washington bureaucrats do in uncertain times. She commissioned a study. In January, the agency published a concept release on the structure of the stock market. After a decade of radical changes, the SEC was at last attempting to come to grips with a vast electronic trading machine that had risen up in the shadows of the market. The commission is publishing this concept release to invite public comment on a wide range of market structure issues, including high-frequency trading, order routing, market data linkages, and undisplayed or dark liquidity, the report stated. It highlighted several dramatic statistics that illustrated how times had changed. In 2004, the average trade size of a NYSE-listed stock was 724 shares. By 2009, the average size had dropped to 268, a result of high-speed algos slicing and dicing orders into easy-to-digest bits. Speeds had ramped up dramatically. In 2005, it took 10 to 20 seconds for an order to get filled on the NYSE floor, compared with just less than 1 second on average in 2009, still far slower than the microsecond speeds on NASDAQ, BATS, DirectEdge, and Archipelago. A flood of comment letters poured in from across the industry, sharply illustrating the rifts that had formed in the market. A number of fund management firms emerged as stark opponents of high-speed traders, whom they saw as little more than quick-draw bandits scalping their orders. The managers of Southeastern Asset Management, which ran the Longleaf Partners mutual funds and oversaw $30 billion in assets, attacked the shift toward automation. The market has become a servant to short-term professional traders, in particular high-frequency traders, they wrote. As a result, the long-term investor, whether an individual, mutual fund, or hedge fund, incurs unnecessary execution and opportunity costs. Perhaps the most curious and thought-provoking letter came from one R.T. Leuchtkoffer. The name was a pseudonym. Leuchtkoffer means firefly in German. No one knew the writer's identity, but the detail and sophistication of the comments submitted on April 16, 2010, revealed Leuchtkoffer as an insider who'd grown disillusioned with the state of play. Right out of the gate, Leuchtkoffer sounded the alarm. As Saluzzi and Arnuch repeatedly argued, the market was extremely unstable because high-frequency traders were likely to cut and run in a market shock, making the shock worse. The last 15 years have seen the rise of new classes of very profitable, aggressive, and technologically savvy participants previously unknown in the U.S. markets, Leuchtkoffer wrote.